All right. You guys, last week we started a series called Welcome Home, connecting and engaging people in the church. And actually, well, not just that, but we want to engage the church in the community. That's what we want to be focusing on. And so we're talking about, what does it mean to be welcomed home? You think about a home and what that means. And you think about, man, a place to come and belong. A place to come and be connected. A place to come and be a part of something. It means to be home. Now, for many, many times, home, maybe it doesn't bring, bring really great memories for some of you. And so that's hard because you think, well, I don't know, home wasn't a very great place for me. A lot of people have told me, going home was scary. I tried to stay away from home as much as possible. I tried to live with my friends as much as I could. I left home when I was 15 years old. I didn't, but people have told me. I left home when I was 15 years old. And you just keep going. That's hard, right? Because we want church to be a place where it's home, where you're connected, valued, loved, understood, recognized, all that kind of stuff. And so we were talking about what does it mean to be have a church be a home. So last week we talked about this out of Titus chapter 3, verses 1 through 11. The big idea was this, is that our lives are a welcome mat for people who need hope. Titus talked all about what life used to be for those Cretans. Remember, he was talking to the people in Crete who were evil beasts, gluttons, liars. I mean, just kind of a really tough, rough culture. And the fact that the presence of Christ really changed their lives, and they're really transformed into a more Christ-like, and that our lives need to be a welcome mat for those people who need hope. Because he says, remember, Titus, you and I were exactly the same. And Paul clearly had been an incredibly destructive person. He was so caught up in his religiousness that he hated others and was committed to their destruction. And then Jesus met him on the road to Damascus and said, hey, look, knock it off, Jack. I am the living God. This is Christ the Savior. He meets him, and his life has radically changed. And he says, remember that? Titus, you are the same as me. Let's help others get there. So that's what we talked about last week, that we need to be a welcome mat for people who need hope. And there's a lot of people who need hope out there. Now, this morning, I want to talk about this. Here's the big idea for this morning. Dealing with conflict is critically important for a healthy church. Dealing with conflict is critically important for a healthy church. And you guys, I wish I could tell you that there's no conflict in the church. Oh, that would be so sweet. And here's this, the hard, difficult thing, is there's conflict in life, right? And it happens in churches. And how we handle it is critically important. Now, just so you know, this week when I told the staff that this is what I was going to speak on today, they all sighed and said, no, don't do it. Don't do it. And I'm like, they said, you just covered it like 9 months ago. We covered it. It's done. It's over. And I'm like, no, there's been some conflict since then. And they're like, yeah, okay, but we still don't want to talk about it because every time we talk about it, it gets worse leading up to it, and it gets worse leading out of that Sunday. So they just knew this past week was going to be hard, and this coming week is going to be hard because every time you talk about conflict, God says, hey, that's great. You guys know how to handle it now. So watch this. When it comes, here we go. And you're like, bad idea, God. I don't think you're thinking very well. And sure enough, the last several days, the next several days, it's just like, it's going to happen, right? It's the nature of life. Life is conflict-oriented. I hate that truth, but it happens. So dealing with conflict is critically important for the church. But can I just say this? Let's cross out church. Let's just cross it out. And let's add some other places where it's critically important. How about marriage? It is a critically important place to deal with conflict. See, God didn't make marriage to make us happy. He made it to make us holy. And so he's going to use that as a place to transform you. Right? How about this one? How about family? Dealing with conflict is critically important for a healthy family. Because sometimes it happens in families. I don't know if you've ever seen that, ever experienced that, ever seen, you know, whatever. But sometimes it happens in families. Sometimes between parents and kids, oddly enough, there can be conflict. Or sometimes between your siblings and you, there can be conflict. Sometimes when older siblings are dealing with the issues of life, they find themselves at odds with one another. Wow. How about in a family? Or what about this? How about in the workplace? I know that doesn't happen for you, so let's move on. But sometimes there can be conflict in the workplace. You know, and how do you handle that? And how do you deal with that? And it's critically important, right? Companies that do a good job of handling conflict are companies where people like going back on Monday morning. And companies that don't deal well with it, going back is not very much fun. Or how about in your neighborhood? Have you ever had any trouble with your neighbors? I'm a trustee in my neighborhood, and sometimes I get called on to help neighbors solve things with neighbors. I have one neighbor who feels like it's not all that odd to take some of their leftover chicken stuff and to put it in the common ground. And the people living next door to them think it's a little bit strange, inappropriate, unhealthy, weird, and they're angry. And so they came to me as a trustee and said, "Can you deal with this?" I feel like saying, "Well, why don't you deal with it?" But in the indentures, it says things like that are not appropriate. And as a trustee, I've had to go and say, "I'm not sure this is really working," you know? But it just happens, right? In your neighborhood, sometimes your neighbors do weird things, you know? Or they think you do weird things. Dealing with conflict is critically important for a healthy neighborhood. How about this one? Dealing with conflict, critically important for the healthy government. Oh, let's not even go there. Okay. Let's just go back. In Matthew 18, and Luke 12, we're going to look at three different areas of conflict that help us deal when we have conflict in a church. You can apply it then to your marriage. You can apply it to your family. You can apply it to your neighborhood, your workplace, the government, whatever you want to apply it to, you can apply it. But in the church, it's critically important. So here we go. Matthew 5. Let's start there. First one. Matthew 5, 21 to 25, and here's the big idea, or here's what it's going to address. When you wrong someone else. When you wrong somebody else. Okay, let's look at it. Matthew 5, verse 21. It says, "You've heard that it was said," this is Jesus speaking on the Sermon on the Mount, okay, the famous Sermon on the Mount. This is like one of the places where he outlines the value system of the kingdom. Right? He's going to just put it all out there. So he says, "You have heard it said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment." Okay, that's good, that's fair, that's right. That's an appropriate thing for any culture to do, for anything that's going to stand on what is truth and correctness. He's going to say, you murder, you're going to be held responsible. There's going to be a judgment. And that's a correct thing to do. Right? And people know there's a consequence to murdering someone else, taking their life unfairly without judgment, without due process, just the murder thing. So it's appropriate. But Jesus says, hey, it's even more important than that. It's more profound than that. He says this, "But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to the same judgment." Now you think, whoa. Isn't it correct to be angry sometimes? Well, yes, it is sometimes. But here's the deal. This word angry, it's orgizo in the Greek. And what it means is to have a set-in anger that is aimed at the person rather than the issue. To be angry, to say, okay, you, I am angry at, and we've been to condemn them rather than the moral content of the behavior. When we personalize the anger and it becomes destructive, he says anyone who is that kind of angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Now, he's going to kind of go on and kind of connect it to some other ideas here. Look at this in the next part. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. Making it personal. Insult them. You idiot. Right? You dumbhead, you know, all the kinds of things we say. You, They personalize this. Now look, it even goes on and says this. And whoever says, "You fool," shall be liable to the hell of fire. Whoa, that's pretty strong. You, the word here is raka. And raka means you stupid idiot, you piece of trash. When they demean the humanity that God created, we've gone too far. And it says that we are worthy of the fires of hell. Wow. Rather than addressing the issue, not the person. Now, yeah, the person did the behavior. We get that. But when we demean the human being, God says, "You've gone too far. I will be the judge. That's not your job." Wow. When we make it personal. So look at this in verse 23. "So, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you." Now let's add to this. Let's just put in parentheses here. "You have sinned against someone else." If you come to the altar somehow worshiping God, coming before him with your full heart, and you remember, "Oh my gosh, someone has something against me. I have wronged them. I know that." He says, verse 24, "Leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift." If you know you have wronged someone else, they may know it, they may not. But you say, "I have judged you, I have called you, I've demeaned your humanity, I have attacked you," whether it be literally or in our own hearts and minds, to deal with it. And he says, don't come here. Because if you come here and try to worship me and you know you've wronged someone and you're unwilling to deal with it, then what you're doing here is simply religious stuff. It's just the hypocrisy of religion. And he says, don't do it. Leave your gift. Put it down, go be reconciled to your brother, and then come back here. And it makes this thing a full of integrity if you do that. But first be reconciled to your brother. Then come back and offer your gift. And look at this in verse 25. "Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court." I mean, so he's kind of painting this picture, right? That this guy has something, you've wronged him. And he's like, "Hey, we're going to court." He says, "Man, hurry up and walk with the dude. And on the way to court, settle it. Don't wait till you get to court and get all, you know, kind of stiff-necked about it. Man, go to him. Lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and the guard and to be put into prison." He goes, "Man, get up next to the guy and say, 'Hey, look, I was wrong. I was out of line. I'm responsible. Wow, could we settle this before we get to court and I get thrown in prison? Could we do something about this? But I'm wrong.'" You know, it's amazing how often when someone comes to you and says, "Hey, I was wrong," how easy it is to say, "Okay, it's all right. I forgive you." I would encourage you, if you go to someone and ask them, tell them that you're wrong. Well, in fact, why don't we do this first of all? Here's the deal. When you wrong someone else, here's the big idea. Take responsibility for your hurtful behavior quickly and honestly in order to make things right. And your job is to go and take responsibility. Their responsibility for the Lord is deciding whether they're going to forgive you or not. Now, I know this sounds kind of strange, but I would encourage us not to go and confess our sin and then say, "And will you forgive me?" Because then all of a sudden you take the onus off of you and you put it on them. And that's not your job. Your job is to take responsibility. And their job is before the Lord to decide if they'll forgive. And if they choose not to, that's between them and the Lord. That's one of the risks you take by confessing the wrong. But as a believer, we need to forgive, right? It talks about that. It's a whole other sermon. But to go and confess it, take responsibility for your hurtful behavior quickly and honestly in order to make things right. And the quicker you do it, the better it goes. You let it hang on for a few days, a few weeks, a few years, a few decades. And you and I both know, all know the craziness that it spins in churches and in families and in neighborhoods and in the government. You just keep going, right? In the workplace. Go quickly and take responsibility and just say, I was wrong. I did that. I apologize. I am responsible. Right? I think that's what Jesus is saying here. Now, there's another place that happens. In Matthew 18, he's going to talk about not when I'm the one wrong, but what about when someone else wrongs you? What happens then in this conflict? Someone wrongs you. That happens sometimes, but look at, let's just see what Jesus says here in chapter 18. He says, if your brother, highlighted here, if your brother sins against you, you're the victim. They sin against you. That sometimes that happens in churches. Sometimes that happens in marriages. Sometimes that happens in families. Sometimes that happens in the workplace. Sometimes that happens in your neighborhood. Sometimes that happens in church. He says this, you go still. If he wrongs you, you're supposed to go. Ah, you think, well, that's not fair. He's supposed to come to me. Well, that'd be great if he did, but it doesn't always happen. But if there's a brother who sins against you, he says, go and tell him. Go put it on the table. Talk about it. Go put it on the table. Look at this. Go and tell him his fault. He may not know. And you start digging in and you're grinding it over in your life. And he maybe doesn't know. Or maybe he does know. But it says, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. You know, isn't that amazing how sometimes when someone wrongs us, the first person we go to isn't them. It's somebody else. And we start spinning it. We start going behind people's backs. And we're telling everybody else. And eventually it gets to them, hey, so-and-so is talking about you, that you wronged them. And you're like, I had no idea. And now all of a sudden it's a big issue. So he says, whatever, when someone wrongs you, go to them alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. You say, hey, you know what? You really wronged me here. And they go, wow, you're right. You guys, then it's over. It's done. It's complete. It's dealt with. It stops right there. We don't have to go through all this Mickey Mouse craziness. But he goes, here it is. If he listens to you, you've gained your brother. Now, look at verse 16. If he does not listen, and if it's necessary to take it to the next level, sometimes it's just you need to let it go, right? Sometimes just letting it go is appropriate. But if it's not something to let go, he says, but if he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If you need to go, take a few others with you who either know the situation or have wisdom enough to come and help the both of you. Take a couple of people with you. Don't blow it up too much too fast. Take a couple of people with you. People you trust. People who will deal with this well. Take them with you. And by implication, if he listens to you, you've gained your brother, right? And that's as far as it needs to go. Now, verse 17, if he refuses to listen, even then, tell it to the church. The scriptures would encourage us, I think, not to take it to the courts. If we can't help each other do well in the church, how sad for us, how sad to us that we're not wise enough to take care of it, not forgiving enough, not kind enough, not honest enough, bringing truth and grace to the table at the same time like Jesus did every time. John 1:14, Jesus was full of grace and truth. He did it perfectly all the time. That's what we're talking about here. How do we have grace and truth? If he refuses, take it to the church. And if he refuses then to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Wow, he's saying if they refuse to listen and deal with it, the most difficult thing you do is to put him out of the church. Treat him like a tax collector or a Gentile. Wow. That's pretty hard. But if wrongs don't go addressed, if they go unaddressed, we allow this cancerous conflict to envelop a church, to envelop a family. And that isn't healthy. So if your brother sins against you, so let's put it here, when someone else wrongs you, seek reconciliation with as little fanfare as possible without forfeiting the truth. Don't blow it up bigger than it needs to be. Go one-on-one. Then take a few others. Then take it to the church. And if they refuse to listen, then maybe you have to go the other way. It doesn't have a time schedule here. If you've wronged someone, go quickly. Here, you figure out what's the best time schedule, right? Okay, so there's partially about dealing with wrongs, dealing with conflict. Now, here's another one. What about when the wrong is between two other people? What do you do then? A year or so ago, I started thinking about this issue, and I remembered someone had said one time, never pick up the offense of another person. And I thought, wow, that's really a wise thought. That's a really good thought. I wonder where that comes from the Bible. Is it in the Bible? I never couldn't remember if it was in the Bible. I'm like, I wonder where that's at. So like any good theologian, I went to Google, and I asked, you know, what about picking up the wrong of another person? And it referred me to Luke chapter 12, verses 13, 14, and 15. And I went, oh, cool, I didn't know it was there. And so I went and read it. And I said, that doesn't say that. It doesn't say that. Like, who? Kind of foolish, it's crazy. And then I began to read it, and I thought, wow, it is what it says. So when the conflict is between two other people, look at this. Jesus was teaching one day, and he came to a place, and someone in the crowd, often he had large crowds following him, and someone in the crowd said to him, hey, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. So you think kind of out of the blue, here's a guy that seems obviously somewhat upset with his brother, that somehow the inheritance wasn't being handled correctly. And he said, tell my brother to share it with me. So it doesn't tell us here, but it sounds like it's probably the younger brother who's saying to the older brother, he's not treating me correctly or fairly. Now the laws of that day out of Deuteronomy would be that the older brother gets a double share and all the other males get their share, how many there are, the oldest brother would get a double share. The gals, not always, but often would get no share because they were supposed to be married off and they went with a dowry, and so their portion of the inheritance went with a dowry. And so it was usually divided up among the brothers. And so here it seems like the younger brother, probably the younger brother, feels like he's getting treated unfairly. And so he says to Jesus, hey, tell my brother to share the inheritance with me in a better way. It seems like a reasonable thing, kind of, sort of, right? So look at this in verse 14. But, that ought to be an indicator, but Jesus said to him, hey man, I don't know if he said hey man, but he kind of feels like it, hey man, hey guy, hey big guy, who made me a judge and arbitrator over you? Now I have to be honest with you, my first thought was, I'm looking around like, hey look, if anybody here can be judge and arbitrator, Jesus, it's you. You know, like you're God. I don't know if you know that, you know, but you're like God. You could do this righteously and correctly. And I think, well, what are you talking about? In fact, if I, you know, wouldn't Jesus be the one who could say, hey, look, why don't you go get your brother, bring him back, we'll hear your story, I'll take Old Testament law, and I'll apply it to this situation, and I will be your judge and arbitrator, and I'll help you guys work this out. Got it. That'd be my tendency. That's why I was like, Jesus, why aren't you doing that? I'd want to say, hey, go get your brother, you know, and I'll play the judge role. I'll play the arbitrator role, and I'll make you guys figure this out, right? And I'll tell you where you're wrong and where you're right and where you ought to blah, 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 right? So what in the world is Jesus talking about here? And so he said to them about this guy, he says, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. He says it to all of them, but he's saying it to this guy. Hey, look, what's going on here? Where's your heart? You want your share, whatever that is. He doesn't even stop to figure out all the details of it. And instead of becoming the judge and arbitrator, he calls the guy to his heart. What's going on in your heart? Are you just being greedy? So it seems to me, when the wrong is between two other people, do not pick up the offense of someone else, but call them to their heart. Because what happens when there's a conflict between two people and they share it with you? Actually, what they're doing is they're trying to get you to take their side. But hearing one side of the story is inherently inadequate to really understand. You don't know. And when you take their side, you create a bigger problem. Rather than saying, hey, look, your side of the story seems reasonable, and if it's the whole truth and nothing but the truth, that's horrible. But I actually don't know. I'm not calling you a liar. I'm not calling anything that. All I know is if I take your side, there's a strong possibility that the other side has some validity to it. And even then, I don't need to take sides here. What I need to say is you need to check your own heart in the midst of this. And are you all wrapped up in bitterness and angry in something so negative? And I'm just going to contribute to it if I simply come and take your side. Rather than saying, well, I don't know, you guys need to work this out. But as you go to that place, you better check your heart. Because you might find that you're the one who created the wrong and you need to go to them quickly and settle it. Or you might come to a place where they're the ones who created the wrong, but you need to go to them still and deal with this one-on-one. Or maybe take a few people with you. Or maybe take it to the church. Or maybe let it go, take its distance. But I'm not going to get in the middle of this because I'm not going to be your judge and arbitrator, because not even Jesus would do that. He was too wise to do that. But he called them to their heart. And I think when we have conflict, sometimes we get sucked into other people's conflict, right? And we, in fact, not just sucked in, we like jump in. Like, yeah, I can help you guys find a better solution because I really got it together here. And we usually make it worse. I was involved in a situation not too long ago, and I thought, see, you know, they're on the same page. And everybody with me said, what are you thinking? They're not on the same page. And I was like so foolish because I thought I could fix it. But it wasn't my conflict to fix. I simply needed to call them to their heart. What's going on deep down inside? So, the big idea here is dealing with conflict is critically important for the church. It is. So let me just kind of apply it a little bit. We always say, so, therefore, what now? And so let me just apply it in this way. First of all, don't be surprised if you cause conflict. Don't be shocked if it's you. It's in our nature. It's in our broken nature. We see things a certain way. We do things a certain way. Sometimes we have very dysfunctional ways of doing things. Sometimes we're the source of the conflict. Don't be shocked. Don't be surprised. Don't think that you're above it. You're not. I'm not. So don't be shocked if you're the source of the conflict. And what do? Own it. Take responsibility. Call it out. Settle it. Let it go. Cut it off, take responsibility, right? So don't be shocked if it's you. Secondly, don't be surprised when others cause conflict. It is the nature of life. It is the nature of the human being. Other people cause conflict, that's the deal. So instead of saying, I can't believe you did it. I can't believe you did it again. Don't be surprised. It's part of the deal. But go to them and deal with it. Talk with them about it. Try to settle it. Make it right. Help them make it right. Right? Don't be surprised if other people cause conflict. It happens. And sometimes it's not quite so simple between you're the one or they're the one. Sometimes it's a mixture of it, right? And you kind of have to work that out. Last this. Don't insert yourself between those who are having conflict with each other. It's a foolish place to be. Don't step in and get between it. Step back and say, wow, I hope you can deal with this. I hope your heart is in the right place. I'll pray for you that it would be. Or maybe sometimes even saying, I'm really concerned about where your heart's at. I see things in your heart that I think you need to deal with. Right? So this morning we're going to celebrate communion. We're going to come up here. We're going to say to the Lord, we're going to come to the altar And we're going to say, thank you so much, Christ, for what you did for me, the fact that you gave your body for me, and you shed your blood for me. And you shed it to forgive the times where I was really wrong. Now, if you're in a place today where there is a wrong that you have committed that you have not dealt with, he says, leave your gift at the altar. Go and make it right before you come back. If you would come and celebrate this simply out of religiousness, don't do it. Go make that right. Next time we do communion, come and do it. Don't come and what the scriptures say is reap condemnation on yourself. If you've done it, if you're doing this just out of religiousness, if you know there's something wrong, go deal with it first. But to come here and to say, well, I come here because Jesus, you solved the conflict between me and God by giving yourself for us, giving your life for me. And I come here and celebrate what you did. So as the band comes up to prepare us for this, I just would ask you to prepare your heart to come to this communion table to celebrate what Christ did for you. And so all those times, you could just list them, you know, this morning if you want to, you can just write them all down. All the times of the things you did wrong. All the sin in your life, all the gunk in your life, all the times you violated someone else. Just write it down in your head and know that what he did is Christ's blood took that and erased it. His body was given for you to make you whole. His blood was shed to make you clean. And so you can come here and worship him. Unless there's a problem in your life you need to deal with first. That I'd encourage you to maybe resist. In fact, resist for sure. Okay? So take a minute just to prepare your heart as you come to celebrate communion.